Why do I conduct my show on this manner? Mondo!
Sweet mother of God, what is the holdup?
Eleanor!
Once again, something wonderful in my life has been turned into a giant crap fest.
Mondo!
Got a little bit more cock for you here.
Eleanor!
Bowtie boy got the big snaggeroonie.
Mondo!
Oh, six of my nipples are tingling.
Eleanor!
See why America loves him so much?
Mondo!
I'd like to smash you in the face with my shillelagh.
Eleanor!
I have no idea what's going on.
Mondo!
He was lying.
He said he never tells a lie.
He was lying when he said that.
Eleanor!
I want a cup.
Well, could you spell that?
C-U-P. I want to see you. Oh, my God.
I know nothing. Nothing.
Stomach batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
For God's sake, strap yourself down.
That's right. It's the show your bosses don't want you to listen to. The show that's going to tell you the truth about what's going on in the workplace. So wake the hell up. It's the Cup of Joe radio show. I am your not-so-humble host, Joe Vecchio, the voice of the working man, the voice of the radical middle, and the voice of those who have been unvoiced by the anti-worker policies of the Bush administration and its corporate allies. Our engineer, Sock Puppet Sam, is here!
Hey, Joe, how are you?
And we've got a lot of stuff to talk about, but first, Sam, give us the URL for the site.
That's cupojoe.blogspot.com.
And the email address.
joevec@bellsouth.net.
All right, I want to welcome all of my fans listening in at the White Rose Society. That's whiterosesociety.org. My good friend Ben Birch hosting my archives there. And, of course, all my fans at rantsradio.com listening in on Thursdays and Sundays.
Okay, it is Sunday, January 16, 2005, 9:36, according to the clock on the wall at Studio Al. I'm Joe Vecchio, and, man, it's been, you know, it's interesting, and I think I brought this up in the last show, how when you're unemployed, sometimes you're busier than you were when you're working, or at least as far as certain things are concerned. And I have been busy like crazy taking care of things around the house and just doing things and organizing things and cleaning things up, things that have needed to have been done for a long time, but just which have not been done. To give you an example, what I did today was I turned the power off the computer, and I generally don't turn the power off of the computer. I leave it running all the time, like most people do. It's always on unless situation forces us to shut it down. But I shut it down and I powered it all down and I disassembled everything and reorganized the wiring. You know, I used to do that for a living, you know, professionally, do audio video wiring. And it was just a huge mess in the back of the machine and I was sick of it. I didn't want it. So I basically redid everything and made it nice and neat. And now instead of a nice mess, there's just a nice, neat set of wires coming down. You can only see like a couple of power things, and everything is nicely attached to the bottom of the desk there with tie wraps, and it's just nice. It's just nice to have that because, you know, let me tell you something. They have, you know, the chaos theory, law of chaos theory, and, you know, chaos theory says that basically everything is chaotic unless we impose order on it. And anyone who's ever worked with cables or wires knows how absolutely and utterly true this is, because tangled is the natural state of cable, ladies and gentlemen. I can speak to you from experience that if you leave it alone, it will become entangled. And that was the situation I was dealing with there. So I also got my old printer out of the storage and set it up here, although it needs new ink. So if anybody wants to donate $20 or $30 for me so I can get new ink for the printer, that would be nice, so I can print out some resumes and things like that. I had been relying on other people to do some printing for me, but now that I have to print resumes and get out. And I've been busy with other things, too. I have been spending money. And a lot of people think, why are you spending money? You're unemployed. Well, there are things that I have to spend money on, and one of the things is nice clothes. And again, I mentioned this in the last show, and I went out, and not only did I buy some new shirts and new pants, well, not new, but, you know, new for me, from a thrift store, I went out and I took the money to get them dry cleaned, to get them pressed, to get them altered. Because every time I buy a pair of pants, you got to understand, I'm 5'2 and I weigh about 200 pounds, which means I have about a 42 waist and a 25 inseam. If you know anything about it, you know, I only know this because I have to know this because I have to look at this. And every pair of pants I have has to be altered, period. There is no such thing as a 40-25 pair of pants that is made. If I want to get a suit, it has to be altered. In fact, I've gotten some jackets, but the truth of the matter is I may have to go somewhere and get a couple of jackets altered specifically. What are you doing, my wife? What are you doing? Oh, she's showing me the kitchen. Hang on, the bathroom here. Hang on. Ooh, that's very clean. That's very clean. She's been sleeping most of the day, and she's sick, so I let her sleep. But she likes to work, too. And she likes to get things done. And I've been, like I said, a busy beaver, cleaning stuff out in the kitchen, cleaning stuff out in our big storage area. I actually bought a couple of little porcelain light bulb things, and I put them inside each of our closets because there was no light inside the closet, and it was a pain in the butt to try to see anything in there. So I just very simply hooked it up, and I hope it doesn't burn the house down. It shouldn't, really. I did a pretty good job on it, I think. At any rate, it's just been taking up a lot of my time, plus the work I've been doing. I've been going to meetings and trying to help out doing this election reform stuff. And we've been talking about, you know, how to frame these issues. And someone, I think it was a Dekos, was it Digby? I'm trying to figure that out. No, it was Atrios. And he was talking about how, for the Bush administration, what they're doing on Iraq is they keep moving the goalposts. I think that's a good way of phrasing it, that they keep changing the rules of the game because the Iraqi elections are coming up on the 30th, and it's not going to be going as well as the Bush administration said it was going to go. And they keep changing what the expectations of it, moving the goalposts, basically. And that's pretty much what they've done for this whole administration, I mean, as far as what they're doing. When they're not outright lying about what they want to do, what their plans are, they're going out and changing their assessments once it's going to show that it's not going to be exactly what they said it would. Honey, could you do me a favor? Could you turn the fan off, please? We have a ceiling fan, and it's a little chilly in here. I'm sorry? Yes, please. And she's going to get me some water, too. My wife is very nice. And if you hear that little click there, that was the fan being turned off. I'm trying to get this place just a little bit more organized because I do not like living, I don't want to say like a pig. I'm very cluttered. I'm not dirty, I'm cluttered. I tend to throw things around. And I need to get some filing and I need to get some other stuff, you know, thank you, dear. And I just need to get things organized. And, you know, that's a problem I have when I work, too, because I tend to be more organized at work than I am at home, mostly because that's where the bulk of my energy is spent when I'm on the job. Excuse me a minute. Little water there. And I'm a really, really big believer in just organizing, being organized and being efficient, doing things in half the time it takes other people to do it. I don't want to say that. That's not the right way of saying it. Just finding that's the simplest and easiest way of accomplishing the same thing. And sometimes that takes a little work to do that. When you're doing that for the first time, you're trying to figure out how things you want to work. And that just makes it easier for the future. But it always takes a little bit of time and effort. And sometimes you try something and it doesn't work out. Have you ever done that? You think you got something going. You think you got something really nice. And then you realize, this is not quite what I thought it was. And, you know, it winds up that you wasted your time. But, you know, it's a learning experience. And life is a learning experience. And that's basically what I do. But let me get out and talk about the news here a little bit because there's something that's been going on. There's a couple of things been going on, and it's all kind of an offshoot of the Armstrong-Williams story. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with this story, Armstrong-Williams is a columnist, a black guy. He's a columnist and a television pundit, for lack of a better term. I hate those words, but he's a guy that goes on television. He was paid $240,000 by the Bush administration to promote their No Child Left Behind Act. That's taxpayer money, by the way. That is taxpayer money being sent to this guy to basically promote this issue, which he did in his column and whenever he appeared on television. And how the right has handled it. And the right, the propaganda machine on the right, is brilliant at how they do these things. But what they have done is that they took they were talking about how Daily Kos or Marcos from Daily Kos took some money from the Dean campaign. Well, Marcos did take money from the Dean campaign, but he was always very upfront about it. He put it on his website. It was very clear. He did some consulting work. He did not blog for the Dean campaign. In other words, he did not write stuff. He wasn't paid to write favorable stuff about Dean on his website. In fact, he had some stuff that was critical of the Dean campaign. And, of course, some of the other posters were critical of the Dean campaign. What are you looking for, honey? Scissors. Where do they put those scissors? Honey, I can't look for them now. I'm kind of busy. there were those scissors in the big room. You want to check in there? If I wasn't in the middle of recording, I would help you out. Professional radio, ladies and gentlemen. But this is how the mighty Wurlitzer, as a call of the right-wing propaganda machine works. They'll take a story and they'll make it into something completely different. Like the story about the soldier who asked Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld about why they can't get the right equipment. And instead of a story about how what kind of snide remark that Rumsfeld gave that soldier, which is what the real story was, and the story of, you know, why we went to war based on a lie and why we went while we were based on a lie without properly equipping our troops to do the job that they need to do, which is why there are as many casualties as there are. We might have gotten half of the casualties if the soldiers had the equipment they were supposed to have. But rather than that, the story became how it was a reporter who supposedly gave the soldier that question. But, you know, that wasn't the story. But they managed to make that into the story. It is remarkable how it works. And a lot of it has come on to the ethics of bloggers. And, of course, the right-wing blogosphere, they get help from the professionals who write for the Republican Party. It's all part of their little welfare system they've got set up. The Swift Boat story, for example. The whole thing, and this is something that affected CBS, which has been, for the most part, one of the most respected news organizations on television for many, many years. And they wound up firing a couple of people, not because the story that they told was wrong, which it wasn't wrong, and not even because the documents that they were accused of that were accused of being forged were actually found to be forgeries. They were not found to be forgeries. There was nothing proven about that. But one right-wing blogger said they might have been forgeries, and that got trumpeted up on, what, Free Republic, which went on to Drudge, which went on to other areas, which got on to the so-called professional media, and then it got blown up in such a big way that CBS was forced to retract some stuff or to let people go. And CBS should not have done that. CBS should have said, this was bullshit. The people who made the accusation about us were themselves lacking in any kind of fact, which they were. So, you know, it's just incredible how the right-wing machine works, and they did a very good job of it. What was it? Frank Rich had a great article about this in the New York Times, and I love the way he phrased it. I'm going to quote this. He said, this is a scenario out of The Manchurian Candidate. Here we find Mr. Cheney. Actually, let me go back on this. At a time when no one in television news can get an interview with Dick Cheney, Armstrong Williams, the guy I started talking about, of all journalists, was rewarded with an extended sit-down with the vice president for the Sinclair Broadcast Group, a nationwide owner of local stations affiliated with all the major networks. In that chat, Mr. Cheney criticized the press for its coverage of Halliburton and denounced cheap-shot journalism in which the press portray themselves as objective observers of the passing scene when they obviously are not objective. That was a quote from Mr. Cheney, Vice President Cheney. Now, this is a scenario straight out of The Manchurian Candidate. Here we find Mr. Cheney criticizing the press for a sin his own government was at the same moment signing Mr. Williams to commit. The interview is broadcast by the same company that would later order its ABC affiliates to ban Ted Koppel's Nightline's recitation of American casualties in Iraq and then propose showing an anti-Kerry documentary under the rubric of news in prime time just before Election Day. And after fierce criticism, which came from the left-wing blogosphere, by the way, Sinclair retreated from that plan. Thus, the Williams interview with the vice president, implicitly presented as an example of the kind of objective news Mr. Cheney endorses, was in reality a completely subjective, bought and paid for fake news event for a broadcast company that barely bothers to fake objectivity, and both of whose chief executives were major contributors to the Bush-Cheney campaign. The Soviet Union could not have constructed a more ingenious or insidious plot to bamboozle the citizenry. And this is partly why that we have trouble getting any kind of real democracy right now in this country. Partly because people are ignorant, partly because people are being misled, and it's partly because the people in power simply don't care anymore. They've reached the point where it doesn't matter what lies they tell. They know they can get away with it. And that's what Bill Clinton said, and that means the reason why they do it is that they get away with it. If they didn't get away with it, they wouldn't do it. They couldn't do it because they couldn't get away with it. And I said on the last show, and then I realized, and I want to make a point here, you know, to all the people who supported the war, you know, and who still continue to say, those are the ones I'm saying fuck you to. I'm not saying fuck you to the people who originally supported the war, maybe based on, you know, false information or, you know, them believing a certain thing, but now realize that it was bad and bad for the country and bad for the world. Those people who have, you know, changed, who understand that the original belief was wrong and have gone on to make amends for that, those people I don't have a problem with. But if you're just still sitting there going, well, we got rid of Saddam and that's good enough, you know, fuck you. You know, so yeah, what about bin Laden, my wife said. Anyway, let me take a little break. Let me see what I can throw together here. Sam, play us out.
We'll be right back with more of the Tucker Joe Radio Show.
That Hitler only had one ball? A lot of people aren't aware of that. Hitler only had one ball. Well, actually, it was an undescended testicle, but what you see is what you got. Hitler only had one ball. People didn't know it at the time. People kept saying things like, Jesus, that Hitler, he must have a lot of balls, you know? No, one. He started all that shit on one ball. The British Army knew about it. British Army had a song for him. Hitler has only got one ball. Goering has two, but they are small. Himmler has something similar, but poor old Goebbels has no balls at all. Ah! Ah! So, thank you. Well, so it's music you want. Well, by God, it's music you'll get, then. I'm a musical fella, and I like my music, and I like historical things about music, like that little Hitler anecdote. Things that are from musical history. Do you realize that the Mexican Hat Dance was written by two people? Nobody knows that. Two guys wrote the Mexican Hat Dance. The first guy wrote, ta-dan, ta-dan, ta-dan. And the second guy wrote, ta-dan, ta-dan, ta-dan. Think about it now. If it hadn't been for that second guy, the Mexican Hat Dance would have gone ta-dan, 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 ta-dan. I would have turned the fucking thing off after about 18 minutes, to tell you the truth. They were so happy with what they did, they went out to celebrate. And they met another guy, and he went this is the kind of shit history is made of. Musical history. You know why I do these things? Because I'm a musical guy. I'm a music. Besides being a balloon fellow, I'm also
a musical guy. I love music. I'm musical. See, I use that adjective for myself. I'm musical. I'm not musically talented. That's different. That's a distinction that's made. It's a distinction that's made usually by people who are musically talented. You've heard them. They'll say, is he talented? They'll say, oh, no. He's musical. That's me. I'm musical. It means if you hit me in the head with a pipe, I make a noise. And I'm like most people. I've written a few songs in my life. You know, I think a lot of people who are musical, you write a song. You might be lovesick or something. You write a little poem and you have a tune for it and you put it away and you don't show anybody. But I've written a few things. I wrote, if I give my heart to you, will you give me a receipt? I got you out of my heart, but I can't get you out of my apartment. Every time I sleep with you, I realize you're tall. What else? Well, I'll think of them, lots of them. I wrote one love song you might have heard of. Here's one you might have heard of, even. Kiss Me, I'm Coming. Do you remember that? Kiss me, I'm coming. Ah! And it goes on like that for about 8 minutes, hopefully. Yeah. I wrote another one. I wrote, nobody knows how I feel, so I keep it to myself. That's kind of nice, too. Also, I wrote a love song for fish. Can you imagine? I did. I wrote a love song for fish. Somebody had to. Mrs. Paul didn't give a shit. Swimming around nude in a tank full of fish sticks? I don't care for that lady. I wrote a nice love song for fish. It's called, lay some eggs in the sand and I'll squirt some jelly-like substance on them. Well, I found fish are very direct in their communications. Also, they'll dance to just about anything. I wrote a country song. I heard your reaction to the country question earlier. I wrote a country song. It's called Drinking Beer, Taking a Shit, and Passing Out. Well, you got to really be a country fan to like it. Also, you ain't been right to me, so I'm going to womp the piss out of you, but for some reason they won't play it on the FM stations. Oh, I'll get to the words. I got a longer list than seven by now, believe me. We'll get to that. That's at the end. Yeah. Something else, though, about some songs. This is my little musical break, and I kind of indulge myself, so you have to kind of go along with it. Instead of taking a real break and going out and lying down, I sort of just talk a little about music. I do folk music, too. I do folk songs, not hardcore folk music, you know, but I do sort of a crossover folk, kind of a pop folk, sort of a country pop folk reggae, classical folk. Classical music is what sort of a boogie folk, you know what I mean? It's a nice kind of folk. I do one. Here's one that everybody loves. If I were a carpenter and you were a lady and I hit you with a hammer, would you think I was crazy? Broadway show, someone yelled, hey, George, how about a Broadway show tune? By God, I do them as well. Broadway show, here's one that everybody loves, especially you. Away out here, we've got a name for rain and wind and fire. We call one rain, we call one wind, and we call the other fire. Well, it seemed like the way to handle things, one name for each phenomenon. Sometimes I do this, but not tonight, I hope. Okay. Certainly. What else? Wait a minute. I got a couple more songs before I get this out of my system. You know what pisses me off in music? No one can tell me the rest of the words to ta-ra-ra-boom-dee. Doesn't this make you mad? Everyone knows the beginning of the goddamn song. Everybody, in fact, people get cocky about the beginning. They go ta-ra-ra-boom-dee. Nobody knows the rest of it. One guy told me it's ta-ra-ra-boom-dee. Did you get yours today? I got mine yesterday. That's why I walk this way. I don't think that's it. Another march they never taught me the ending to. Oh, the monkey wrapped his tail around the flagpole to see his asshole. Dun, dun, dun. And they leave you hanging there, you know, just like the goddamn monkey.
And we're back in the Cup of Joe radio show. I'm your not-so-humble host, Joe Vecchio, voice of the working man, voice of the radical middle, and voice of those who have been unvoiced by the anti-worker policies of the Bush administration and its corporate allies. Once again, the URL for the site is cupoje.blogspot.com. joevec.com. And the email address is joevec@bellsouth.net. And once more, I encourage you to write a comment on the blog or to email me. And I realize, you know, I haven't had a lot of posts lately because I've been a busy, busy little beaver, as my wife would say. But, you know, shit happens, and you got to deal with it. I do the show for nothing, and I have a little bit more time, but my time is right now occupied in other things. Once I get the place organized a little bit, and once I get our stuff that's I don't want to say it's in storage. It's just in our big – there's like a big room in the basement here that's supposed to be like a public room, but most of our stuff is in boxes in there. And I really, really want to go through all that crap and get it organized and sorted out and put it up on shelves. So at any rate and so it's cutting into my time blogging right now. But, you know, it's no big deal. It's no big deal. I get my hits, and people come and listen, and people still comment, and people still email me. I've got some interviews lined up. I got some other things going on, and hopefully I'm going to get some help from the political friends that I'm meeting from the election reform issue, and we can get a crew together. And I've already got one guy, and I was supposed to call him this weekend, but I was so damn busy. By the way, my friend John from Pittsburgh, and by the way, congratulations to the Steelers for luckily beating the Jets. They lucked out, man. They fucking lucked out. The Jets should have won that game. That guy missed two field goals, and he missed the one with 1 second left. But anyway, my friend John, he almost had the right answer. Last show, I mentioned something called Vandalay Industries. And I asked my listeners to see if they knew what that was a reference to. And when somebody gets it right, I'll say it. John came close. And I don't want to say what he said because it would give it away too much. But John came close. And John lives in Pittsburgh. So next episode, we will deal with that. I want to continue on the subject I've been talking about because the blogger ethics thing is a really, really big thing for me because it really speaks to the heart of what's been going on in our industry. And all the two main bloggers that I read, Atrios and Daily Kos, have been really on this story strongly because it's an important thing. And it's something that we really kind of need to speak loudly about because what the right wing is trying to do is discredit everybody on the left. I mean, they've been doing it with the mainstream media. The blogosphere kind of took them by surprise. But because they have this propaganda machine already well built, they can put it together. And Digby's been on this story. Digby of Hullabaloo. And I'm going to try to get him on the show, although he says he has a voice made for things other than radio. I can't think of the right expression. The expression is you have a face made for radio. And that does describe me, by the way. But Digby's been all over saying he was talking about how CBS was forced to let a couple of people go over the so-called Rathergate scandal. But really it wasn't. It was a bullshit scandal completely made up. Hang on a second. And Digby talks about what I've been talking about, how, you know, it's taken about 30 years for them to really build up this machine. And I'm going to quote this entire thing, and I don't usually do this much of it, but I want to quote this entire thing because Digby really hit the nail on the fucking head on this. If you go on the website, my website, by the way, cupofjoe.blogspot.com, and you will see the link for Digby under regular reads. It's called Hullabaloo. And it's one of the better blogs. Sometimes he'll go for a couple of days without posting, but when he posts, man, it is big, and he'll write something really, really big and very, very spot on. And he quotes this from The President and the Press by David Wise in The Atlantic magazine. In April 1971, John Ehrlichman, the president's chief assistant, this is Nixon, President Nixon's chief assistant for domestic affairs, complained in person to Richard S. Sallent, the president of CBS News, about Dan Rather, the network's White House correspondent. Ehrlichman was in New York to appear on the CBS Morning News with correspondent John Hart. Afterwards, Hart and Ehrlichman adjourned for breakfast at the Edwardian Room of the Plaza, where they were joined by Sallent. The president's assistant brought up the subject of CBS White House reporter. Rather has been jobbing us, Ehrlichman said. Sallent, seeking to inject a lighter note into the conversation, told how Rather had been hired by CBS in 1962 after he had saved the life of a horse, an act of heroism that resulted in considerable publicity and brought him to the attention of the network. It was then that Rather went to work for CBS News as chief of its Southwest Bureau in Dallas. Rather, by the way, is a Texan. Not a lot of people know that. It was then that, when President Kennedy was assassinated in that city, Rather went on the air for the network, and his cool, poised coverage of the tragedy gained him national recognition. After Dallas, Salent explained to Ehrlichman, CBS brought Rather to Washington in part because the new president, Lyndon Johnson, was a fellow Texan. Aren't you going to open a bureau in Austin where Dan can have a job? Ehrlichman asked Salent. He then accused Rather of never having come see him in the White House, and he suggested it might be beneficial if Rather took a year's vacation. Walt, to continue on with the in another part of the book, Walter Cronkite believes the Nixon administration attacked the news media to raise the credibility of the administration. It's like a first-year physics experiment with two tubes of water. You put pressure on one side, and it makes the other side go up or down, Cronkite said. He added that he has charged that this is a conspiracy. I don't regret my use of that word. By applying constant pressure in ways seen and unseen, the leaders of the government have attempted to shape the news to resemble the images seen through the prism of their own power. The administration's attacks, Richard Salent acknowledged, have made us all edgy. We've thought about things we shouldn't think about. And that's the end of that quote from that article. Now, what Digby goes on to say is that that article was written in 1973, and it was before they set the second part of their plan in motion. While diligently working the reps for the last 30 years, they were simultaneously building an alternative media to push from the competitive side and drive the discourse to the right. Today, that dream of control is fully realized. Republicans routinely bully any reporter or organization that doesn't play ball, while they feed lots of juicy propaganda to their bought and paid for media like Fox, Rush, Drudge, and the New York Post, knowing that the story will work its way into the mainstream anyway. They created an entertainment model for news in which entertainment values superseded civic values, and it attracted a different kind of person to the field. Over time, fewer and fewer reporters wouldn't play ball because those that refused were weeded out in a form of unnatural selection. In the end, the survivors don't even know they are biased. They are so enmeshed in a system of celebrity punishment and rewards that their own self-esteem is now drawn from their acceptability to the Republican establishment. Republican is in parentheses, because the Republicans are basically the establishment. And each and every day, the partisan right-wing media pushes the discourse a few inches further to the right. So this last week, we found out that Armstrong Williams is being paid by the taxpayers. Remember, that's taxpayers' money, $240,000 to promote the president's political agenda, and the Social Security Administration employees are being required to disseminate Republican talking points to the public during a major policy battle. That's another bit of news that just came out, where the Social Security Administration is being forced to spend money to advertise the changes that Mr. Bush wants to make in it, which, in effect, will lead to the destruction of Social Security. So basically, Mr. Bush is telling Social Security people to pave the way for their own destruction in that sense, firing or whatever. Kind of like when our company, Siemens, started moving stuff down to Mexico. They wanted union people to go down there and train the Mexicans to do the stuff. And the union said, are you fucking nuts? What, are you fucking stupid? Of course, you know, it's the union people who are fucking stupid right now because they're the ones that are losing the jobs. I mean, that plant is losing something about 20-25% of its workforce, probably even more, come the end of March. At any rate, to continue on with what Digby's saying, Social Security Administration employees are being required to disseminate Republican talking points to the public during a major policy battle. There are undoubtedly many more examples of the literal merging of state and party. But the media has long since been corrupted by a far more sophisticated legal system of payola and influence peddling. It makes little difference now whether there are more Armstrong Williamses, because there are many, many people who will happily perform his function while taking a check from a right-wing foundation or think tank. The right-wing noise machine works like a single organism, relentlessly attacking any threat to the Republican Party, unquestionably advancing anything their leadership directs. It's just plain greed that led them to use taxpayer money where there is so much special interest money to be used for the exact same purpose. In a just world, this Armstrong-Williams scandal would get at least the exposure of the selling of the Lincoln bedroom tale got in the Clinton administration. At the time, there were endless stories about abusing the public trust and forcing the taxpayers to foot the bill for partisan activity. There were months of hand-wringing and hanky-clutching and how will we ever sleep again knowing that political activity took place in the people's house. Anybody want to lay a bet that this scandal produces anything like that? Are any Democrats prepared to go on television and perform a soap opera prosecution featuring phony pathos and crocodile tears about sending a message to the children? Are we prepared to boost ratings and give the media reason to defy the White House and the right-wing message behemoth with a show they can't resist? Certainly, when given the chance, our hard-boiled political operative, Paul Begala, didn't even nick Armstrong with a ballpoint pen on Crossfire, much less stick the shiv in, as Novak would have been so delighted to do if the shoe were on the other foot. And Novak, of course, is the guy that should be in jail, because he was the one that leaked the story about Valerie Plame, the CIA agent, which other people are getting arrested for, but Republicans are good at that, getting people to take the blame for their crimes. And Atrios continues, I'm not holding my breath. The fact that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq is causing nary a peep from anybody tells me that even body bags and billions cannot shake the machine. I'm not sure anything will except total economic meltdown. Sadly, we may just get our wish. And I was talking to some people during the election reform meeting that we had on Saturday, and I was bringing up the article that I wrote a couple of years back that got printed on Democratic Underground and made the rounds in a couple other places too. But it was an article I called Waiting for the River to Catch Fire. And the example that I used, the river, so to speak, was the Cuyahoga River, which goes through Cleveland. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with the story, let me point it out. It was – now, Cleveland is an industrial town, middle class, working class type of town, very blue collar. And there's a lot of industry that goes on there because of its position on the river. And the Cuyahoga is the main river that flows through Cleveland. And it was being polluted, something awful. And I'm sure that while this was all going on, that there were people talking about, you know, oh, it was being polluted and stuff like that. And there were business people saying, oh, it's not as bad as what you're saying, blah, blah, blah. And people were going back and forth and back and forth. And, of course, while the back and forth was going on, more and more filth kept getting poured into the river. Well, eventually, the river caught fire. It caught fire. For those of you who are familiar with the story, I'm not telling you anything new, but it's true. It's the truth. In fact, Randy Newman wrote a song about it. If you watch the movie Major League, which is a really, really good baseball movie, by the way, with Charlie Sheen and, God, who the hell else? Anyway, that's not the point. At the beginning of the movie, they showed they were showing scenes of Cleveland, and they were playing the Randy Newman song that he wrote about that called Burn On, Big River, Burn On. And at any rate, I use that analogy to say, look, you know, eventually – you know, Americans are like that. We tend to wait until the river catches fire until we do something about it. The federal government had to step in and clean up the Cuyahoga, which they did a very, very good job on, I should say. Certainly, you were not going to expect the companies, the industrialists who were doing the polluting, to make any changes. You wouldn't think they would you, honey? They know. She's saying she's busy doing something. But at any rate, you know, this is what's been going on, and I would have thought that the 2000 election would have been where people, you know, the river caught fire, or that the 2002 elections, or even the 2004 elections. But you know something? People aren't really doing anything. In fact, the year after I wrote Waiting for the River to Catch Fire, I wrote a sequel to it called Roasting Wieners at the Pier. And that's basically what we're doing. The river has caught fire, but we don't seem to care. We don't seem to care about the Armstrong-Williams story. It's just something that's getting splashed back and forth. You know, and I was having arguments and fights with some of the people there who are further left than I am. Most of them are. Some of them are Greens. And I'm not particularly fond of the Green Party in particular. But, you know, I've known some of these guys for a while from other things. And I was explaining to them some of the things that we need to do. And one of the, you know, to get people's attention to this whole election story, because it's all kind of like, well, it's all, you know, it's all done. Nobody really cares anymore. It's happened and, you know, get over it and all that shit. The Republicans don't play that way. In Washington, where the Democratic lady won the governorship after a very close vote, after two recounts where she won by something like 135 votes, the Republicans are taking it to court. They're suing. They're not accepting defeat. But we tend to do that all the time, you know? So anyway, I said what we need to do to get people's attention is to do something really, really big that will really get attention. And one of the things that I recommended was rigging an election, just going ahead and going in there and rigging something. No, what I'm saying is you rig something. You know, my wife said you're no better off than that. You don't have to rig a national election. Take one county somewhere or one state somewhere and rig it so that all the votes go to Mickey Mouse. Do something like that. You know? Do something like that. And they're like, why? You know, get out there and fucking do something. You know, you talk about participating in the process, and guess what? The process is not going to work for you. You talk about taking things to court, guess what? The judiciary is going to be against us too, especially since Mr. Bush is going out and putting his people in those positions. And the Democrats aren't fighting it, of course. You know? There's sometimes you got to go outside the process. You've got to do something that will make people really, really wake up. And until it really starts hitting the upper middle class and the paychecks, and the upper middle class, who is still a fairly large percentage of this country. Ugh, stop that. My wife is erasing. And you know how sometimes when people like scratch their nails on the chalkboard, I get that kind of feeling when people are erasing a lot. Ugh. But that's all right. But, you know, we really need to do something. I mean, it's not just about election reform, but so many other things. And we have such a long way to go. You know, and sometimes you just got to do something like that. Because these people are smart. They can figure out a way to do this. And they can go out there and they can beat the Republicans at their own game in that sense. And just make it look so ridiculous that people will clamor to get the right process. So what we're trying to do is that we're trying to get everybody focused on a process that regardless of what kind of technology that we have out there, the process of counting the votes ought to be as secure and public as possible. In every precinct, what we ought to do is they have – never mind counting by machines even. Count everything by fucking hand. Count everything by hand and do it publicly with an audience there, with cameras, with a video going feed going to, you know, wherever the next level is. Because it's not the precinct level, then the county level, then the state level, then the national level, however it works. Okay? District, county, state, however it works. You start at the polling places where the votes are. The votes, the ballots, after the polls are closed, the ballots are opened up, and by hand, in public, they are counted. Those results are shown on video screens, and there's people there in the audience with their own video camera, and they're shown very publicly who's voted for what. And if you do that all over, it's not going to take that much longer than the optical scans of the computer ballots, because the precincts you're operating on small level, you're talking about a couple of thousand or so votes in most places. And you do that, and they send it to the next center, and they keep tabs. They've got all the boards right there showing where the precincts are. Then they do it at the county level, and the county level goes to the next level and say, these are the reports that we got. But the ballot is your evidence. The ballot is your evidence. And I don't want to get too much in detail but about what they're doing because they don't want to go too crazy on it. But that's basically it. But we've got such a long way to go. I mean, it's going to be so difficult to get people to that point. And maybe sometimes you got to do something like that. Maybe sometimes you got to set fire to the river yourself. And what I'm suggesting, rigging one vote in one spot, is not dangerous. And nobody's going to get killed. Especially if you do it for Mickey Mouse, you know. Do it for that. I mean, that's what the expression everybody uses. Oh, what a Mickey Mouse election. But what a Mickey Mouse organization, you know, which pisses the Disney people off, I'm sure. But that's, you know, that's the euphemism that they use. And if we can just do it with the computer voting, we can prove how fucked up the system is. And especially here in Georgia, because all over in Georgia, we have the Diebold machines. We do everything by computer. And that vote is gone in the thin air. You don't know where it's gone. And, you know, your vote is your freedom. This is one of the things that I wanted to talk about how to frame the message. Your vote is your freedom. When your vote disappears, your freedom disappears. And, you know, we've got to, you know, rhetorically speaking, we've got to lob bombs from the balcony. we got to make our presence known and make our presence felt in these big ways. And that's one of the reasons why that Digby and Atrios and Kos are getting so on about this this blogger ethics thing. It's important to hit back on this. We have to stand up for ourselves because you know something? We do this for nothing. There is no sugar daddy on the left building up an organization that's similar to what there is on the right. I wish there was. It would be nice. But there isn't, so we have to deal with what we've got. At any rate, let's take a little break. Sam, play us out.
The Papa Joe Radio Show will be right back.
And we're back on the Cup of Joe Radio Show. I'm your not-so-humble host, Joe Vecchio, voice of the working man, voice of the radical middle, voice of those who have been unvoiced by the anti-worker policies of the Bush administration and its corporate allies. Again, the URL for the site is cupojoe.blogspot.com, and the email address is joevec@bellsouth.net. I think I'll get a new email that I can have it forwarded to that to make it easier. Cup of Joe or something like that. We'll see what I can do. We'll see what I can work out. Let's see. What was I going to say? I was going to talk about... I came across an article in the New York Times about how Mr. Bush is going to go back to the ownership society mantra. Or not mantra. That's not the right word. But that the way he's phrasing that. And, you know, this is something that, my nemesis, Beachon, talks about how he wants it to be that way. But... you know, part of it is destroying Social Security, or you know, they want it to go into the hands of they want to privatize it basically. There was an article last week in several different sources about how the British have actually did that many years ago under Thatcher, and it turned out to be a total mess. And in fact, the plan that the British are now looking at going to is America's Social Security. You know, look, as I've said before, with the Bush administration and the Republican leadership, whatever they say is basically the opposite of what they actually mean. So when they talk about an ownership society, what they really mean to create is a slave state. And that's what they really want. That's right. An ownership society means they own everything. And you own squat. They're talking about getting lower income people to be able to buy a house. How in the name of hell are they going to be able to buy a house? I've said this before. You want an ownership society, you have a liberal government that guarantees a certain amount of money that's going to be made, a certain amount of wage control and price control is going to go on. People get paid a living wage. I've said this before. My dad, 30, 35 years ago, made $6.50 an hour on that one salary. He supported a family of five. Granted, we didn't live luxuriously, but we always had a roof over our heads. We always had food on the table. We always had clothes on our backs, and they were able to save enough money to buy a house in Florida. And we always had nice gifts at Christmas, too. You know, it worked. That was your ownership society right there. Because it gave people, it had people earn enough money for their regular jobs to do the things to support themselves, plus have money left over. That's an important thing. That's an important thing. You know? And basically, what Social Security is something that these guys have wanted to get their hands on, you know, forever. Ever since they started it in 1935, the Republican leadership has been trying to get rid of it. They hate it. They hate it because it's a government program that works, that disproves their ideology that says nothing the government does any good, and that's horse shit. They hate it because there's a whole bunch of money that they can't get their greedy little fucking hands on. That's why they hate it. And that's how they see us. They see us as having money, and they want it. They can't stand the fact that somebody else has money that they don't have and they can't control. They hate that. They absolutely fucking hate that. And they want to get their hands on it so bad. You know, they want this total fight for yourself, you know, the cream rises to the top type of bullshit. And, of course, the cream doesn't really rise to the top. It's just those who are more ruthless. And sometimes just plain fucking lucky to be born into the right family, man. You know? I mean, I don't think that's any kind of skill. You're born into a family of billionaires that already have their own little social safety net. And you want to deny to everybody else. But it's like someone talked about the Puritans. They said the Puritans are people who live in constant fear every day that somewhere, somehow, somebody is having fun. They can't stand that thought. And these people, you know, they go to sleep at night worrying that somewhere somebody's got some money that they don't have. They want it. They can't live without it. We've got to rethink a few things. We have to rethink how our entire economy works. We have to, you know, money plays such a huge part in what our politics are. And, you know, it really ought to be a separate thing. You know, there ought to be a balance. Just like there's checks and balances within the government, there needs to be checks and balances within the society. There's a time and a place for capitalism. There's a time and a place for governmental action. You know, you just have to know what the balance is. You have to know how where one begins and where the others end. No private industry would have built the federal highway system. It wasn't profitable for them. Why should they? That's not their responsibility. No private industry would have built the Hoover Dam or to it was the Golden Gate Bridge. But no private industry would have tackled the rural electrification program, maybe on an individual basis in some small sections, but no private industry is going to build something on that kind of scale because it's not profitable for them. There's no purpose for them to do that. But they're willing to do it. But if the government builds it, that's what government does, and businesses make money off of that. Businesses made a huge fortune because of the federal highway system. The South became economically stronger because rural electrification gave them electricity and therefore air conditioning, which made more people want to move down here. Let me tell you something. If there wasn't air conditioning down here, nobody would fucking move here. My wife is shaking her head. Shit, no. Jesus Christ, you know how hot it gets in the summer here? And it does. It gets very hot and humid here in Atlanta in the summer. The winters aren't too bad. The winters are kind of mild. It's a nice place to winter. If it wasn't for air conditioning, the South wouldn't be worth a shit. Nobody would come down here. It would still be mostly rural. Still is mostly rural, really. At any rate, the point is that there are things that government does that work. And there's things that business does that work. Healthcare is another thing. If the government handled the healthcare and just by taxes, it works. It would work like an HMO or something like that. I really don't know about the economics of it. But basically, everybody pays their taxes. You get to choose which doctor you go to. And you have a healthcare plan where you don't have to worry about whether you can afford to pay for it. It's already covered. People talk about the Canadian system that they have, you know. Governor Dean said, you know, we're not going to get a single-payer system like they have in Canada, but let's do what we can to help out people now. Because while we're arguing about it, the poorest people are still trying to fight through the system. Look like my wife, whose operation keeps getting delayed and delayed and delayed. And it's all because she's poor and she can't afford to go to, another doctor. And we go to Grady Memorial Hospital, which is wonderful. They treat her very nice. But they're understaffed, and they're getting funding cut, so... Anyway, I'm going to cut it out here. This is Joe Vecchio from the Cup of Joe Radio Show. Hello to my friends at rantradio.com and from the Ben Birch Society, the White Rose Society from Ben Birch. I will see you on Thursday. I'll talk to you on Thursday. Bye.
I want a cup of Joe. I'll crave a plate of Dave. Open a jar of John. Don't put anything on. I'll chug a jug of George. I'll sip a mug of Doug. The creamer of Steve, how many more does that leave? Give me a pot of Scott, heat up a pan of Stan, throw in a handful of Dick, that'll do everything. Open a can of Dan, make a meal of Sam, but don't give me no mo, cause what I really want's a cup of Joe.
The Cup of Joe radio show has been recorded live at the fabulous Studio Al in Decatur, Georgia, and has been produced by Jove Enterprises, Incorporated. Joe Vecchio, the host of the Cup of Joe radio show, is a production of Mr. and Mrs. Vecchio of Brooklyn, New York.
A plate of Dave, creamer of Steve, a mug of Doug, a cup of...